Here's a few headlines for you. Seven shot in strike rioting, strike fails in big plants. Italian rebels in Yugoslavia counterattack beaten off. And over 20,000 carloads of potatoes will be shipped from Wisconsin this year. It's the latest news from 100 years ago in the Wauwatosa News. That's September 26, 1919, 100 years ago today. Thanks to a project from the Wisconsin Historical Society and the Library of Congress, you can look at that paper and thousands of others from Wisconsin and across the country online. Matt Blessing is a state archivist and director of library, archives, and museum collections for the Wisconsin Historical Society. Matt, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, can you tell us what you are doing with this project to, preserve old newspapers?
Well, it's a terrific way to democratize the newspaper collections, which are currently on microfilm. Most of them are on film. And as a lot of listeners probably know, the Wisconsin Historical Society's library is the North American History Library for the UW-Madison, and it's always been national in collecting scope from Maine to Hawaii. But we also collect comprehensively in terms of Wisconsin historical newspapers. And we have more than 3,000 newspapers published in the state of Wisconsin since we were a territory. The first newspaper published in Green Bay in 1833. And this is a partnership project with the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Library of Congress. And we're entering our third grant cycle, where we've received generous $250,000 grants since 2015 to digitize Wisconsin newspapers, free access, and it's all keyword searchable. So you can look for anything from recipes or a hobby or, of course, do genealogical research. And at this point, with the two first round 24-month grants, we've digitized newspapers from about 16 counties, a total of 40 different newspapers. And we're having really good feedback from local historians to students participating in National History Day, where they need a primary source. And it's all about providing convenient access to the historical resources at the Historical Society's library.
I want to talk about what a labor saver this is going to be for people, because I've done research working for other people scrolling through microfilms, and I've done it even with scanned newspapers on a computer, but not keyword searchable. And what that means is you look, in both of those cases, at every single edition of the newspaper every single day until you find the stuff you want. This is, I mean, there are probably people out there weeping now to know this is available and how much easier that's going to be.
Right. An earlier generation, if you think about graduate students who would have to laboriously go through hundreds of reels of microfilm and read it carefully. Now the method is you take a reel of the master microfilm, and we can scan that reel of microfilm, which has 1,000 frames, in about 10 minutes. And then we do optical character recognition of those scans. And that enables the researcher to, again, find the recipe or something specific to a hobby that they're interested in, or somebody's surname to find their great-grandparents. Huh. And that's what makes all of us a little lazy, right? Because of this work that's being prepared by archivists and librarians to deliver the resources and to have it so readily accessible.
You said 3,000 different newspapers. That is a surprise to me. Wisconsin has had 3,000 different newspaper titles over the years?
Well, over the years, the names of the same newspaper tends to change. You might have an editor who switches political parties and they switch the names. But yeah, there's a rich tradition of publishing newspapers in the state of Wisconsin, going back to the Green Bay Intelligencer in 1833. That newspaper was not the first thing printed with movable type in the state of Wisconsin. The same guy in Green Bay had issued lottery tickets about 2 weeks earlier, and we don't have any copies of those lottery tickets, but we have his newspaper.
Talk about, you've touched on it a little bit, talk about the different things people go in 2019 to these old newspapers, you know, up to, you know, almost 200 years old. What are people using these things for?
Well, some of our younger staff working on this project have a regular Twitter account where they've been featuring some of the really neat finds that they've discovered during the process. One of my favorites is a newspaper article from the Watertown Weekly Leader from April 19th, 1912, and it's that newspaper's first report on the sinking of the Titanic.
Wow.
And so we have those initial reports suggesting that 1,200 people had lost their lives. But in this story in Watertown, it's highlighting the 11 individuals from Wisconsin, and the initial reports in late April were that six of them were lost at sea. So it's a really nice example of a global event, but looking at it from a local perspective, and of course all history is local. Then there are things that are just, you know, whimsical that really give a nice amount of local flavor. So one of the staff members tweeted about a minister in Rosendale who was under investigation because he did the two-step at a Saturday night dance in Rosendale. And the parishioners were looking into him because it was unseemly conduct for a minister in 1920. So fun things like that.
Well, it sounds – I should ask before we go, how long is it going to take to get through all available Wisconsin newspapers if this project keeps going out into the future?
Well, it's kind of a multi-tier process. We work with major commercial library vendors and have for many years where they digitize a lot of our newspaper collections that are of national scale. So, for example, we have one of the finest collections of African-American published newspapers in the country. And those are the types of things that are available from a commercial library product. These Wisconsin newspapers, which we really want to make sure they're free and publicly accessible, it will take many years. But the NEH program, the National Endowment for the Humanities program, has been wildly successful, and we hope to be involved in the grant program for many years to come.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That was Matt Blessing, State Archivist and Director of Library, Archives, and Museum Collections for the Wisconsin Historical Society. He was with us today to talk about their efforts to digitize historic Wisconsin newspapers. Watch out for that two-step. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. For an inmate leaving prison, getting a job can make the difference between success and ending up back in the system. For women at Tichita Correctional Institution in the Fond du Lac area, they've got a new program for developing some key job skills, including a certificate in welding. That program launched earlier this year with some assistance from Moraine Park Technical College and the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. Rachel Frida-Gady joins us now. She's a social worker at Tichita. Rachel, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about what's involved in this welding program this year at Tichita, what the inmates are learning, and how they're able to practice the trade?
Sure. So this is our first time doing this program. The ladies, we have about eight participating in each cohort. So they're really learning a lot of skills that kind of trains them for an entry-level welding position. So that way, that when they get out in the community, they can, you know, have the criteria met just to be to walk into a job and say, you know, I've got a certificate, I know the skills, I know the machinery, you know, can I have a job? So it's really something concrete that they can walk away with from while they're here.
And to paint a little picture here, this is kind of cool. It's this mobile welding lab that can go for now in Tichita. It might be at another prison in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So
we actually have a CNC program at one of our other sites, too. So that's proving to be really successful. So I know we're really hoping that the kind of the same thing can come of this program.
And what kind of response are you getting from the inmates who are going through this welding program?
They're very excited. I know there is definitely a waiting list for this program. You know, it's something different. And I think that for women, there's such opportunity for them to get into these kind of fields. It's not something that, you know, they've always thought that they could do. So now seeing this opportunity here for them, they're really excited, especially after hearing, like, from some of the other successes we've had with our other programs, like the CNC program. They're really excited for the opportunities that they can get when they get out of here.
And then this is a partnership, right, with one of the technical colleges in our system?
Yep, correct.
Which one is working on that?
This Marine Park Technical College here in Fond du Lac.
In addition to this welding program and that CNC program you mentioned, there is, I understand, a new job center there as well. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. So this has been really exciting. I'm actually going to be going there later this afternoon to work with some of the ladies. So we partnered with the DWD. They even have said that our job center here is nicer than some of the job centers they actually work out of. So you walk in, and it really just looks just like a job center. You know, it's got the logo. We've got all the computers. Everything's brand new in there. So what the ladies do is they come kind of in groups, depending on when they're going to be releasing. They kind of get oriented with using the computer, using the software, getting set up with an account on the Job Center website. And then depending on kind of what their needs are, it depends on where they'll go with that. You know, it might be they need help with resume building. They might need help identifying, like, what kind of skills might I be able to match with a job when I get out. Some of them need some help with, like, soft skills, job interviewing, things like that.
And you mentioned the Department of Workforce Development, the DWD, and I guess their interest in this in part is there's a shortage in some places in the state and some jobs of workers. Is that part of the goal here to help meet the state's labor needs?
Yes, absolutely. You know, having ex offenders is a really good labor source for a lot of people. You know, there's so many jobs open up, and this is just a really untapped population that finally people are starting to realize that could have a lot of potential and do a lot of good for us. You know, gives them something positive and meaningful to go back to, helps them make connections with people in the community that would be positive for them, and gives them a purpose. So,
talking to Rachel Friday-Gady from Tichita Correctional Institution, social worker there, talking about job programs at the institution, including a job center and a welding program there right now. And Rachel, I want to follow up on that last point you made. Mm-hmm. How important is it, assuming we want inmates not to show up back at Tichita in the future, how important is it to get them on the path to a job?
Well, you know, a stable job not only provides them a source of income when they get out, but again, it gives them a constructive use of their time. Something that I hear pretty frequently from our ladies is that, you know, they get out, they don't have anything to do, they get bored. They start thinking about things that maybe they shouldn't be thinking about. They get involved with the wrong people, and then here we are again. So not only does it give them, you know, stability and income, it also gives them, you know, something positive, pro-social ties to other people in the community. It gives them so much opportunity.
And while they're still incarcerated, does it help to have this kind of goal that they're working toward along the way?
Yeah, absolutely. Research actually says that, you know, connecting our offenders with programs prior to release helps them build that relationship, and then they're more likely to maintain that relationship when they are released. So, you know, it helps them put a face with a name. So some of these DWD staff that are actually here will be working with some of these ladies upon their release into the community. So, and if not, they're going to be, you know, working with people at other DWD sites to kind of connect them ahead of time. So they're not just going in there and not sure about things.
Now, without these kind of programs, job training programs, what are the obstacles for someone leaving prison finding a job?
It can be difficult. I mean, there is definitely still some stigma around, you know, having a conviction on your record. And I think, too, what I hear a lot is that these ladies, they don't really know what kind of skills they have, so they don't know where to start. They don't have any guidance. They kind of just get lost in the shuffle with things, and they're kind of stuck. They end up doing lots of jobs, lots of odd jobs, things that they don't necessarily want to do just to try to get by. And, you know, they're not getting any real, you know, pleasure or gains out of it. It's just kind of here's a job, I go to work, I go 9 to 5. You know, it's not something that makes them happy. Having these opportunities to kind of find something that fits what they want to do, what they enjoy doing, what they already know, and then also providing that education, you know, through our vocational programs also gives them something concrete to walk out of here with.
As we wrap up, Rachel, we've talked about some applied programs like a welding, about the job center. What's next? What's down the road at Tichita when it comes to workforce training for the residents, the inmates there?
I know that we are going to try to partner with some staffing agencies, too, to try to do some, like, little resource fairs and mock job interviews, different things like that. I know that's something that the ladies have been asking for, is they want to practice. You know, what do I say? How do I say it? How do I talk about having a record? That's something that they've maybe never had to have a conversation for.
Rachel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's Rachel Friday-Gady, social worker at Tichita Correctional Institution. Talked to her today about a new welding training program for inmates at the women's prison. According to research from the University of Illinois, 52% of black girls sampled in college and high school in the Midwest have experienced sexual coercion. That often means they've been verbally or physically pressured into unwanted sexual activity. And last year, African Americans were the second largest group of people to report being victims of a sexual offense in Wisconsin, with more than 800 cases, according to the State Department of Justice. Our next guest says there are ways to stop that. Crystal Carter is a clinical assistant professor and field liaison in social work at UW-Milwaukee. Crystal, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you. Thank you.
You've worked directly with trauma survivors in Milwaukee. What have those experiences shown you about the problem of sexual assault and sexual coercion among black women?
Well, that a lot of women are not believed, and often it appears to be victim shaming in regards to whether it's how they dressed or what they said or some kind of way that they were enticing the person and just not being believed at all by whether it's family members or authorities. And so oftentimes they just, when they come to counseling, is when those disclosures happen. And the criminal justice system possibly not even convicting someone, but just not feeling believed and not feeling heard, which is one reason why, as I stated in the article, the Me Too movement was established for black and brown girls who felt that their voices weren't being heard because of so many in our community who feel that way and go so long not expressing themselves and telling anyone because they feel like they're not going to be believed.
And I said women. This tragically is a problem for black girls from a very young age. Can you talk about that part of the problem?
And so black girls who are coming of age, if you will, may have experienced sexual abuse by someone that they know, which happens often, whether it's a boyfriend or a family member. Also, based off of their, where they may live, it may be situations where they're kind of lured in, and that could be someone that is, at the school. It could be someone who is, again, just in the community that can lure them in to a situation and then make verbal or physical threats to harm them or others, family members, and abuse them that way. And a lot of times, often it could be in situations where they're not even aware, particularly if it's like, say, a teenage girl and this is an adult male, and they may see that as a relationship when that is, of course, not a relationship, but it is, abuse and it's not legal. And other people may be aware of that and not say anything as well. And so girls end up being in situations where they're being assaulted and they are being sexually harassed just based off of the fact that, either they don't see it that way because of how the relationship started, or again, it's someone that they know and they do not report it because they feel like they're not going to be believed, or they do report it and nothing is done.
You wrote in a recent piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that the devaluing of black women and black girls, this is not something new. It has roots deep within American history. Can you talk about that historical background that leads us today, as you make the case, to not take black women and black girls' reports of sexual assault seriously?
Sure. When we talk about when slavery started, And we're at our 400th year from 1619, and when the first 28 slaves came to this country, and black women were raped, and they were also bred to have more slaves. And so part of kind of the devaluing is to say, okay, this isn't really abuse, this isn't really rape because they like it, this is, you know, they're promiscuous, they're heterosexual anyway. And so this narrative has went from one generation to the other in one way or another. And so even in the article, I talk about how the Racy Taylor situation that happened in the Jim Crow times, when most black women would not report that they were raped, she did, and nothing was ever done about that. And so when you think about today and you think about the images of black women have often been negative, as well as very sexualized. It just continues that myth. And so if I believe that this person is not a victim, then I don't take their call seriously of rape or assault. And so it's something that we continue to do with our images, particularly in social media and in the media itself. And so that's a narrative that we have to also be educated about, that this is a history, this is historical, it's not something that just happened, and how to begin to portray black women and women of color in positive images and in positive ways.
Talking to Crystal Carter, clinical assistant professor and field liaison in social work at UW-Milwaukee, talking about sexual assault and sexual coercion of black women and especially of black girls. Crystal, how do we do that? How do we change the narrative from that stereotype, the over-sexualized fast girl image that people often apply to black girls, to that more positive image you were just talking about?
Well, I think education is one way, educating ourselves about the history of black women and black girls, as well as using positive language when we're talking about, you know, I mentioned in the article about the fast girl, and that's usually around puberty time, and understanding child development and explaining that to children, empowering children to know when something's not appropriate or someone is being inappropriate with them. But I do think that particularly in our time of social media, I think how we portray women of color, showing positive images, even mentoring girls is one way to help with those images. But I do think education is a big part of that and understanding the history.
Do there need to be changes, institutional changes, in things like law enforcement, the legal system, the social work system, to take reports of sexual assault more seriously?
Yes, and I think that's just in general. As you know, victim shaming is a big part of the defense, and understanding that when women and girls don't report right away, that there's reasons to that, and the criminal justice system is a big part of why we don't, you know, hear a lot of girls and women saying, you know, something happened to me, because it usually oftentimes doesn't, if they even get time at all, it's not a lot. And particularly if this is a person that's, you know, famous, or this is a person who is popular in that community. And as well as having people of color in those, making those decisions, black women making those decisions about whether they be jurors or whether they be a part of the policy that can change some of these situations.
And you write about, in addition to those institutional changes, you reach out toward communities. What do you want to see communities of people of color do when it comes to watching for these incidents, reporting it, and changing the culture?
Reporting. Reporting is a major piece to this. It's not up to us to decide what's right or what's wrong. We often need to just report this to the authorities and let them investigate. Also, knowing how to talk to black girls, about their bodies and giving them a safe place so that they can tell someone. And working with agencies, I've had several agencies since this article was published that has reached out to me because they want to help parents talk to their children about personal body space and boundaries and what's appropriate, and also letting children, you know that they, you know, it's safe, and that discouraging keeping secrets. And I think that sometimes parents need, you know, help with that, and agencies and counselors can do that.
It's a good place to leave it. Crystal, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Crystal Carter, clinical assistant professor and field liaison in social work at UW-Milwaukee. She was with us today to talk about how to protect Black girls from sexual coercion.